crime rate. Councilwoman hesitates. Public gets irate, but forgets the vote dates. Weatherman complaining, predicted sun, it's raining. Everyone's protesting, boyfriend keeps suggesting, you're not like all of the rest. Garbage ain't collected, women ain't protected. Politicians using, people they're abusing. The mafia's getting bigger, like pollution in the river. And you tell me that this is where it's at. Woke out this morning with an ache in my head. I splashed on my clothes as I spilled out of bed. I opened the window to listen to the news, but all I heard was the establishment's blues. Gun sales are soaring, housewives find life boring. Divorce the only answer, smoking causes cancer. The system's gonna fall soon to an angry young tune. And that's a concrete co-fact. The Pope digs population, freedom from taxation. Teeny bops are uptight, drinking at a stoplight. Miniskirt is flirting, I can't stop so I'm hurting. Spencer sells her hopeless chest. Adultery plays the kitchen, bigot cops than fiction. The little man gets shafted, sons and money's drafted. Living by a timepiece, new war in the Far East. Can you pass the Rorschach test? It's a hassle, it's an educated guess. Well, frankly, I couldn't care less.
It's Tuesday, August the 4th, 2015, and today we're talking about debt and the creation of a global crisis based on debt. As you know, debt has been a major part of our conversation here on Lead Stories. We talked about the forced and politically engineered bankruptcy of the city of Detroit that has been ongoing here on Lead Stories. We've been talking about that for almost 2 years now. That historic bankruptcy court filing to discharge $18 billion in debts still wreaks havoc with Detroiters who now must live under the yoke of blistering austerity. Detroit, however, was and is a template for almost 60 U.S. cities said to be on the brink of bankruptcy because of debt. And we know that Puerto Rico, as we've been discussing, a U.S. territory, is grappling now with an onerous debt, an unpayable debt of some $73 billion. Debt, though, is a geopolitical contrivance, says Yanis Varoufakis, who on July the 6th quit as finance minister in Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras's government in Greece, opposing European Union, International Monetary Fund, and bankers' demands for drastic cutbacks to service the country's debt obligations. In a wide-ranging talk in Seattle 3 years ago, when he was an economics professor, Varoufakis, a Marxist, deconstructs the myth of a global debt crisis. There is a crisis, he admits, but quite to the contrary, it is not one of debt. In fact, the global crisis has to do with money surpluses. Here is Yanis Varoufakis on debt crises and the world economy.
Permit me to begin by deconstructing my own title. I shall be arguing that there is no such thing as a debt crisis. There isn't a debt crisis in the United States of America. There isn't a debt crisis in Europe. And there's no such thing as a debt crisis in my own country, which is nevertheless being consumed by debt. You know the joke about two balloonists whose balloon has been blown off course by hideous winds, and at some point they manage to regain control of their balloon and they lower it above a farm, and there's the farmer that comes out and looks up towards the balloon and the... says he must be an economist. Precisely accurate and hopelessly useless. Describing what we're going through now as a debt crisis is precisely accurate and hopelessly useless. It's as we have a doctor here amongst us. Hi, Steve. Imagine if you had a terrible case of a cancer patient in acute pain, and your diagnosis was that this poor person is experiencing a pain crisis. It wouldn't be particularly useful. Debt is a symptom. And it is a symptom of our generation's 2008, to be precise. It's what happens when a financial implosion begins at Wall Street, then it's transmitted to the real economy, and then all sorts of dark forces break out, break loose, and they start dismantling the economic and social fabric of the global economy. These awful events happen once every 100 years. We were unfortunate enough, and especially our children, were unfortunate enough that we had such an event a few years ago, back in 2008. Now, let me be a bit more precise about the question concerning debt. In this country, almost the whole spectrum of political opinion is pinpointing debt, especially federal debt, as a major problem. And it is quite provocative on my part to be saying that there is no such problem. But let me explain why I think it's not a problem. After 2008, what has occurred in this country, but also in Europe and elsewhere, is what I refer to as the Twin Peaks problem. One peak is this mountain of unsustainable, unrecoverable debts and irretrievable losses, primarily losses of the financial sector. That's the big one peak, huge peak. You look at it and you think, oh my God, you know, there's a debt crisis. But then there is another peak just behind it, which is quite often not seen, overshadowed. But it's just as tall. It's the peak of huge, gigantic, gargantuan savings with nowhere to go. You may not have heard of it, but the world we live in has the highest saving ratio in the history of capitalism, as we speak now. So we have accumulated profits and savings with nowhere to go, too fearful to be invested into productive uses, simply because of the crisis. So this is the Twin Peaks problem that I've been referring to. So when I say there's no such thing as a debt crisis, I don't mean that there is no debt, and that debt is not a problem. The debt is a huge problem, just like the cancer patient has a serious problem with pain. But it is analytically unhelpful to be thinking in terms of a debt crisis. We might as well refer to the crisis that we are going through as a savings crisis, as a crisis caused by too much savings. You've never heard anyone in Bloomberg or NBC or CNN refer to this as a crisis of a glut of money with nowhere to go, but it is just as much a crisis of a glut of money with nowhere to go as it is a crisis of debt. Now, let's begin at the beginning. Let's talk about debt. Reading the mainstream outlets, newspapers, or listening to idiotic stations like Fox, you'd think that it is possible to have capitalism without debt. Well, it isn't. Once upon a time, it was possible to have an economy without debt, or with debt that is marginal in terms of the role it plays. Look, recall feudalism. What was the process that led to the accumulation of wealth under feudalism? It began with production. Peasants worked on the land. They produced wheat. They produced corn, right? So production came first. Then came distribution. So the sheriff would come in, take a large part of that mountain of corn, for on behalf of the landlord, distribution between peasantry and the gentry. And then eventually you had financialization. Very mild, but nevertheless you did, because the landlord would sell in rudimentary, marginal markets his surplus, and with the money would indulge in some money-lending activities. So that was the financialization. So you had production, distribution, financialization, and debt creation. But financialization was just came at the end, and it was not essential for either production or distribution. With capitalism, beginning with the enclosures in England and the awful clearances in Scotland, what you had was the perfect reversal of that project, of that process, I should say. So, how is capitalism different to feudalism? Once the peasants were thrown off the land and they became landless peasants, some of them, very few, were kept on by the landlord, and they were given the task of organizing production. Production usually involved sheep, whose wool was an international commodity once the international trade routes have been established, and wool would be exchanged for silk in India, and that silk would be exchanged for swords in Japan, and then those swords would be sold back in England for a lot more wool, and the whole thing would start again. So the ex-peasant who is now running the show on a small plot of land handed over to him by the landlord would be acting as a proto-capitalist, an entrepreneur. Effectively, he would borrow money from the landlord in order to pay for three things: the rent of the land, wages, pitiful wages, but wages nevertheless. They could have taken the form of corn, but they didn't have to be monetized, to the ex-peasants who are now wandering in the countryside, knocking on doors, hoping to get employment because they don't have direct access to the land, okay, and some machinery for, you know, shears for clipping the ship's wool, right? So land, labor, and capital would be purchased or rented in advance of production on the basis of debt that the entrepreneur, ex-peasant, now has to the landlord. So debt comes first. Then comes distribution of income in the form of a labor contract. You will work for so many hours and I'll give you so much corn. Before production begins, and then comes production. It was the combination of this reversal of the order from having production followed by distribution followed by debt to having debt first, then distribution, then production. It was this reversal in conjunction with the great improvements in technology that unleashed the productive powers of capitalism, and capitalism managed to produce immense wealth and at the same time produce poverty that had never been known before. So this is the contradictory aspect of capitalism. So debt is to capitalism that which hell is to Christianity, and something unpleasant, but absolutely necessary. That doesn't work without it. Okay? So in a sense, capitalism is about ecological economics, even though we don't even know that, and capitalists certainly don't want to hear of this. It's about recycling. We heard of the term recycling back in the 1970s from the Green Movement, especially in Europe. Capitalism has always been about recycling. The process that I described is what? It's a process whereby the entrepreneur, the ex-peasant, who is now forced to be an entrepreneur — they didn't choose to be entrepreneurs, it was the only way of making a living once they stopped being peasants — would do the following: would use debt in order to energize the production process after having distributed income in advance of production, by effectively taking his hand and pushing it through the timeline into the future, grabbing value that has not been produced yet. That's debt. Bringing it to the present, energizing the production process, producing the wealth from which he hoped that he would be able to repay the debt, the money lenders, later the bankers, cover for the fact that he had already paid wages and for capital goods, machinery, and hoping that there would be something left for him in the form of profit. So effectively, there is an intertemporal That is all about intertemporal recycling. You take value from the future, you bring into the present in order to create a lot more value so as to deliver the value to the future from which you took a part. The problem with this process is that once you start it and it works and you make a lot of money out of it and history suddenly starts being measured in terms of years as opposed to decades or centuries, because that's what capitalism did. It accelerated the pace of history, both through technology and through wealth accumulation. The moment you start doing that, it's like having a machine that prints money. So you want to use it more, you know, faster and more intensely to produce even more money. Now, the trouble is that if you overreach and you take too much value from the future to break it into the present, that is, you create too much debt. At some point, you can't generate enough value in order to deliver it to the future. So your recycling mechanism breaks down. And there is a second problem, too. The places in which, and the regions and the sectors in which this dynamic capitalist process is managing to push the boundaries of technology and to create wealth. Those are the surplus regions. It started, for instance, in Manchester in Britain and in Amsterdam in Holland, and it's always localized. So there will always be deficit regions and surplus regions. So Manchester was in Northern England was in surplus back then, Southern England was in deficit. Now it's the opposite. Similarly, you have California, New York State, Washington State being in surplus, Texas being in surplus, and you have Illinois, you have the Dakotas in deficit. You have Missouri, which is your equivalent to Greece, I think. Permanent bailout by the rest of the United States, I've been told. And the thing is that whereas markets are amazing institutions for allocating existing goods and services amongst consumers, they are chronically bad at creating a balance between the deficit and the surplus regions, the geographical problem with recycling, and intertemporally. Firstly, remember that if debt comes first, and then you have distribution, and then you have production, suddenly the moneylender, who later becomes a banker, who later becomes Wall Street, plays a hugely significant role in this process. Because the banker is the conduit of that recycling, intertemporal recycling mechanism. And when they get an increasing proportion of the wealth produced as a result of their mediation of that process, and given that, a failure of a banker is not the same thing as a failure of a steel maker or a clothes maker. Because if the bank fails, the whole thing collapses, like it did in 1929. Suddenly, there are two things that must happen, inevitably. One is that society will demand that banks were not allowed to go to the wall, and then when they are not allowed to go to the wall, then bankers are effectively given a carte blanche to print money for themselves. And then the whole recycling mechanism breaks down, like it did in 2008. Now, it is often said about the European Union, and in particular the Eurozone, that we made a huge error in Europe of binding together disparate economies by means of a common currency. Well, this is not the very first time that this has happened. It happened in the United States of America. You have disparate economies in the United States of America bound together monetarily. I mean, Missouri and Washington State, they are just as different as Germany and Greece. But what is it that keeps the United States together? You had a Great Depression here in the 1930s. Things were awful. Steinberg wrote The Grapes of Wrath as a result. And yet, I don't believe there were any moves, political moves, to get rid of the deficit states of the United States of America, like they are in Europe to get rid of Greece and Portugal and Spain and whoever else happens to be in deficit. The reason is that in the United States of America, the state, the federal state in particular, especially after 1929, has stepped in and played the role of a regulator of surplus and deficit recyclings around the land. So let me give you a very simple example. Since we're in Seattle and there's Boeing here, and I believe that they are sponsoring the town hall series of lectures, when Boeing goes to Washington to the Pentagon, for instance, to get a contract for the next generation of fighter jet or drone or whatever, right? They may get it, they do get it, but there are some strings attached. Like, for instance, that, you know, we want a factory that builds the wings or the engines or something in Tennessee or in Missouri or in Arizona in the deficit regions. This is not an act of philanthropy towards the deficit regions of the United States. It's an act of recycling surpluses so that the surpluses of the surplus states can continue to be created, produced. Now, you may recall that in the 1920s, internationally, we had a common currency. It was called the gold standard. So fixed exchange rates, it's like having a single currency. And that gold standard created a degree of growth, together with the emergence of the great corporations like Edison, which allowed the bankers to run riot and to reach far too much into the future to bring value into the present and to recycle. And the result was the roaring 1920s, which led to the collapse of 1929, which was that generation's version of 2008. Okay? And when that collapse happened, what you had was unsustainable debts, irretrievable banking losses, a Wall Street collapse that infected the real economy, the collapse of the common currency, and Nazis in parliament, which is what we have now in Greece, exactly the same, by the way. Okay? Now, the generation of the new dealers in this country that came to power in 1932 were exceptionally fearful of what would happen to the United States of America and to world capitalism after 1944. Because they very much feared that after the stimulus, which was the awful stimulus that was the Second World War, was over with the emergence of peace, that the Great Depression would come back. So they had learned their lesson from the gold standard era. And they did what? They reintroduced a fixed exchange global regime. It was the Bretton Woods system, if you recall, where the dollar was the linchpin, and all the other currencies around the world were locked at a specific exchange rate into the dollar. But they did not repeat the error of the 1920s of just binding together the economies of the world without having a mechanism by which to recycle surpluses around the world. Because it was that lack of a surplus recycling mechanism which brought about the disaster of the 1930s. And those in power in Washington in 1944 onwards were very acutely aware of the need of that surplus recycling mechanism. Interestingly, in the Bretton Woods Conference 1944 in New Hampshire, there was a big clash between the representative of the United States there, a certain Mr. White, and the British representative, who was somebody that you may have heard of, John Maynard Keynes, the famous economist. Both of them agreed that the new global system of fixed exchange rates had to come with that which was missing in the 1920s. And what was that? It was the global surplus recycling mechanism. But they disagreed on what that should look like. Keynes, representing the dying empire of the British, the very much weakened previous dominant country, was recommending multilateralism in today's parlance. That is, that we should create something like the United Nations or World Bank, which is well instituted, and through representation, democratic representation of different countries on it. He referred to it as an international clearing union, what I refer to as a global surplus recycling mechanism. We should all agree together as humanity on how to recycle surpluses. Mr. White, the representative of the United States, said, not on your nelly, mate. It's our surpluses. You don't have any. None of you have any. You're all in ashes, covered. The only country, the only creditor nation left on this planet is the United States of America. We have surpluses. I agree that we have to recycle them, but we will recycle them in precisely the way we choose and whenever we choose. And we're not going to consult with you about it, and we're certainly not going to turn this recycling mechanism into a kind of United Nations of surplus recycling. It is indeed the case that from 1949 to 1950 onwards, the United States of America recycled 70% of its surpluses to Germany and to Japan. It's an astonishing number. 70% of profits made in this country were recycled into the industries of Europe and Japan. The Marshall Plan is just a very small part of it. I won't bore you now with details. But that was not an act of philanthropy. It's just like when Boeing goes to Washington, it is not an act of philanthropy on the Pentagon's part to instruct Boeing Corporation, to build factories in the deficit states of the United States. It's just pragmatic economics. Unless the deficit regions are dollarized, that was the term used back in the 1950s by United States federal government functionaries, unless Europe is dollarized, unless those who don't have dollars are given dollars to spend purchasing the net exports of those who have surpluses, then those who have surpluses will very soon stop having surpluses. So this is the surplus recycling mechanism. Thus, we had the 20 years of the golden age of capitalism, the 1950s and the 1960s, a period with immense stability, very low unemployment, no price inflation, and universal growth. We had lots of other problems during that period, but at least from a macroeconomic point of view, it was a golden age, was it not? Now, why did it end? It ended because this global surplus recycling mechanism could no longer be sustained. Why? Because the United States of America, by the end of the 1960s, stopped having a surplus. So how can you recycle a surplus if you don't have it? Well, enter in 1971, a young Turk, actually, he wasn't a Turk, he was an American, but you know what I mean, Paul Volcker. The name may ring a bell. In 1971, Paul Volcker was an unknown person working for another American, well, actually, yes, Henry Kissinger, that you may have heard of, before he became Secretary of State, when he was still the National Security Advisor. Volcker's paper, which when I read a few years ago, I thought it was perhaps the most remarkable document to have emerged from Washington in the last 50 years, 60 years or so, asked a very simple question. Now that America is losing its surplus position vis-à-vis the rest of the world, primarily Germany and Japan at the time, China had not emerged, of course, back then, how are we going to retain our hegemony and dominance? And he gave a very concise and quite brilliant answer. If we can't recycle our own surpluses, we might as well recycle other people's surpluses. And this is precisely what has been happening between the mid-1970s and 2008. The United States of America, utilizing its trade deficit with the rest of the world, has been operating like a huge vacuum cleaner, sucking into the United States the net exports of Europe, of Japan, and, of course, later China. Thus, providing the net exporters of Germany, of Japan, of China, with the requisite demand which is necessary to keep their factories going. So the ever-expanding trade deficit of the United States was not an accident. It was a very clever way of replacing one surplus recycling mechanism with another. The first one was the one where America had the surpluses and it was recycling them, with another one where America decided that instead of doing what Germany is doing at the moment, which is cutting its nose to spite its face, and therefore they're entering into recession too because they're applying austerity upon themselves by cutting, Volcker and Kissinger initially and Connolly, and then Volcker as the head of the Fed a bit later, had a different idea. We're going to expand our dominance and our wealth by expanding our deficits and using our deficits in order to provide the rest of the world with the demand which is necessary to keep their factories going, even at the expense of ours. And who is going to pay for the deficit? Because if I have an ever-expanding deficit, at some point the bank is going to tell me that, you know, it's game over. But if you are the United States of America and you have the reserve currency of the world, and certain other factors that I will touch upon a bit later. What you can do is you can expand your deficits as long as you create the circumstances so that German entrepreneurs, Japanese entrepreneurs, later Chinese entrepreneurs, take their profit, which they earn as a result of your deficits, and they send it to Wall Street, thus closing the cycle of the recycling loop. So effectively what we had is this. Between the 1940s and 1971, 72, 73, you had global surpluses being recycled from the United States to the rest of the world, the capitalist world, the Western world. Okay? So the United States was a net exporter to Europe and to Japan. It was making profits, which it was then recycling to Europe and to Japan to keep them going so that they could keep buying its net exports. Once that surplus was lost and the surplus shifted to Japan, to Germany, and to China, the idea that Volcker had was we swap this, we just turn it on its head. And what we do is we expand our deficits so they can expand their profits, and that is self-sustaining to the extent that their profits come to the United States to finance our deficits. And this is precisely how it worked. The trouble was, and if you want, we can discuss a bit later exactly how the capital gains, the profits of the Germans, the Japanese, and later the Chinese, were attracted to the United States. There were some key elements to that. One was the immiseration of blue-collar workers in the United States, because that kept prices low. And even though the oil crisis pushed prices up everywhere, prices in the United States rose more slowly than they did in Japan and in Europe. So if you were a Japanese or a German entrepreneur and you had profits, where do you invest them? Where do you keep them? You keep them in the place with a relatively lower inflation rate. That's one reason. One mechanism that helped the United States attract the capital, the profits from the rest of the world, that closed that loop. Wall Street was another, with its amazing capacity to create metaphysical value out of nothing. Walmart was another, because it promoted the ideology of cheapness, which for me is encapsulated so brilliantly in the 1 gallon jar of pickles that was selling for $2.79. Nobody needs a gallon of pickles in their fridge. I don't think you can actually fit one in there. So why was Walmart producing it? I think it was just a symbolic gesture to establish the importance of low prices as an end in themselves. And in the process, squeezing labor costs both here and elsewhere, and creating the circumstances for profit rates to rise higher and faster than they did in Germany and in Japan, so as to attract German and Japanese capital into the United States of America. Now, what do you think bankers do when you give them between $3 and $5 billion every day, net, to play with, even if it's only for 10 minutes a day, at 9 o'clock in the morning, between 9 and 10 past 9? They get $3 to $5 billion. This was the amount, this was a tsunami of capital that was coming from Europe and Asia. On average, every working day, Monday to Friday, into Wall Street, $3 to $5 billion net was flowing into the Wall Street banks. I'll tell you what they do. They find a way of making it grow for themselves, which is natural. I mean, you know, it's in the nature of the beast. That's what bankers do. Now, we can spend countless hours discussing how they did it. One word captures the whole process. It's called financialization. I call it the production of private money, if you want toxic money. Because all those derivatives, swaps, paper titles that contained intricate and complicated and sophisticated forms of debt, effectively, started being utilized by banks as means of exchange and stores of value. They used them in order to exchange them amongst themselves, and in order to store value that was going to the bankers in the form of bonuses and so on and so forth at some point when they cashed their share options in. Now, what is it? How do we define something that works as a means of exchange and a store of value? It's money. So effectively, bankers were given a license not to kill but to print. It was like it was as if they were they managed to discover an ATM in their own living rooms that wasn't connected to any bank account. This, and therefore, what did they do? I mean, if I had one of those, I would keep using it. Increasingly, I don't know about you, especially if nobody noticed. Okay? You know, I mean, the trouble with crisis like the one we have now is that there are multiple explanations for it. So you hear lots of people talking about regulatory capture, the fact that the Wall Street bankers captured the politicians and regulators, which is true. And therefore, they managed to avoid any serious regulation or to have all the regulations that were set up by the New Dealers in the 1930s being swept away by people, awful people like Larry Summers and Mr. Rubin and Mr. Geithner in the 1990s under the Clinton administration. That's true. People talk about greed. Greed is good. We had, you know, Hollywood movies proclaiming that. Oliver Stone tried to portray this in order to warn against it. The result was that the Wall Street bankers were imitating Mr. Gecko. So it's like war movies that create warmongers. At the same time, you had another explanation which had to do with the way in which finance tapped into computing power in order to create exceptionally complex derivatives. All that is true, but what underlying this? And what's underlying the crisis of 2008 and the reason why the world economy has failed to recover since 2008 is that this surplus recycling mechanism, this very newfangled, weird, wonderful, audacious surplus recycling mechanism that Paul Volcker described in 1971 and which he helped put together as chairman of the Fed in the late 70s and early 80s. It broke down. In 2008, when Lehman Brothers went down and all the others followed and had to be bailed out by you folks, what happened was that the United States of America lost its capacity to utilize its deficit, trade deficit, in order to recycle other people's profits. So if you look at the data now, since 2008, I've been doing it now in the context of writing the second edition of this book, which is out there, you'll find an astonishing empirical datum, and that's the following. Today, the United States is producing 30% less demand for the rest of the world's manufacturers than it was in 2007. 30% is a very big reduction. And at the same time, remember the recycling? The rest of the world, whereas in 2007, they were financing United States corporations to the tune of $500 billion a year. Now they're taking out of it $50 billion. So that America is not producing demand for foreign manufacturers, and foreign manufacturers are not sending their profits to the United States of America. 56% reduction in the assets held by non-US residents in the United States since 2008. 56% reduction. So that loop, which was working so magnificently between the 1970s and 2008, has broken down. The reason why the United States is failing to recover, and the reason why Europe is in such a shambles, and the reason why the dragon is angst-ridden in China, is because we have lost about $1 trillion worth every year of demand for manufacturing globally. And we've lost it because the surplus recycling mechanism is broken. Now, the United States created one after 44 and recreated it in the 1970s in a very strange way, in a very unbalanced way, but nevertheless did. Since 2008, we have not managed to regain our poise because that mechanism broke down. Now, this emphasis today in the United States public debate on debt is the homage that austerity pays to misanthropy in order to maintain what I call the new regime that we live under, which is not capitalism. Capitalism died in 2008. Now, because you see, when I'm an old left-winger, right? So when I was growing up, I was having these very nice debates with my liberal, libertarian, right-wing mates and professors and so on. So they were arguing that in favor of capitalism, capitalism is like a jungle. It's a Darwinian struggle for the survival of the most efficient and the fittest. And the left was arguing that this is not so, but central planning is better, you know, because it's also more just, blah, 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 blah. Now, in 1991, the left died when the Soviet Union and its satellites collapsed. In 2008, capitalism died. Because if it's true that capitalism is a social Darwinist game that gives rise to the survival of the fittest, what's been happening since 2008? We have the survival of the most bankrupt. I call it bankruptocracy. It's ruled not by banks, but by bankrupt banks. And the more bankrupt you are, the greater your power of extraction of wealth from the rest of society. So this emphasis on debt is nothing more than a conspiracy in order to exploit ignorance and prejudice and fear. Because if I'm right in the proposition that I'm putting to you, that what we have here is a breakdown of surplus recycling, which has as a symptom a lot of debt and a lot of savings, and the two of them can't communicate with one another in order to wipe out one another, then this emphasis on debt is the revenge of Herbert Hoover, and nothing more than that. Because if we look at one of the Twin Peaks and not at the other, and we say, let's cut down on debt, effectively all we'll manage to achieve is increase debt, like we're doing in Greece. In Greece, we have had the most brutal, most substantial fiscal squeeze in the history of humanity. If you look at the numbers, nowhere before has the budget been squashed so savagely. And what has happened to the debt? It's gone up from 121% to 200% of GDP. Because this is what happens. When you kill the cow that should produce the milk, you have no milk. And if you keep hitting it, it won't produce more. So the problem now with the world economy and the United States economy is, how do we start recycling global surpluses again in a rational way? Now, the great advantage of being a barbarian and of having no qualms about lying through your teeth, as some politicians in this country and in my country, in all countries, have been known to do, is that you can use simplification in order to confuse people. This story that I've been trying to tell is quite complex. You know, when I'm being interviewed by the media, you know, you have about 20 seconds to answer the question, so what's wrong with the world? So if you say, well, we have too much debt, the Chinese own it, so we become their slaves, like these awful advertisements prior to the election here, yeah, that makes perfect sense. It's completely wrong. But, you know, you can just say it like this, it's over and done with. It's exceptionally misleading and catastrophic, but nevertheless, it's a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, which you can tell in 20 seconds. My story, I've already been talking, you know, and fast for such a long time, and I still have not managed to piece it together fully. So when I was trying to tell this story some time ago, with Joseph Halevi, a very good colleague of mine and friend, we were trying to think of a metaphor. And the metaphor I thought of was that of the Global Minotaur, which is the title of the book. Now, one of the very few advantages of being Greek is that we have a great wealth of mythologies, of myths, from which to draw little stories by which to tell a story about the world. So I'm going to finish off by reading one page out to you. This is what I've been trying to do here. And because I'm trying to save on paper, I have it on the phone. It's a story of the Global Minotaur, which is effectively everything I've been saying so far. But what I'm going to read out is very dear to my heart, because one of the great joys of publishing this book was that it appealed to people that don't know anything about economics, and therefore are much more sensible than we economists are. And one such group of people were a group of graduates from the Royal College of the Arts in London who want to create an animated story out of my book. And they asked me to write the script. So allow me to read the script. It's only one page. And that's how I'm going to finish. And see if you can recognize in this little story, which is just dipping into Greek mythology for inspiration, the broader economic story that I've been relating to you so far. Okay, so here we go. Once upon a time, in the famous maze-like labyrinth of the Cretan king's palace, there lived a creature as fierce as it was tragic. Its intense loneliness, comparable only with the fear it inspired far and wide. You see, the Minotaur, for this was its name, had a voracious appetite, which could only be satiated in order to guarantee the king's reign by means of human flesh. The king, the iron-clad Minon, who secured peace, was the one that enabled trade to crisscross the high seas in bountiful ships and spread prosperity's benevolent reach to all corners of the known world. Alas, the beast's appetite could only be satiated by human flesh. Every now and then, a ship loaded with youngsters sailed from faraway Athens, bound for Crete, to deliver its human tribute to be devoured by the Minotaur in his labyrinth. A gruesome ritual that was essential, however, for preserving the era's peace and for reproducing trade and prosperity. Millennia later, another, this time a global Minotaur, rose up. Surreptitiously, from the ashes of the first post-war phase, the one created by America's New Dealers, from the ashes of the war. Its lair, the global Minotaur's lair, a form of labyrinth, was located deep in the guts of America's economy. It took the form of the United States trade deficit, which consumed the world's exports. The more the deficit grew, the greater its appetite for Europe's and Asia's capital, with which this American Minotaur satiated its hunger. What made it truly global was its function. It helped recycle financial capital, profits, savings, surplus money. It kept the gleaming German factories busy. It gobbled up everything produced in Japan and later in China. And to complete the circle, the foreign and often the American owners of these distant factories sent their profits, their cash, to Wall Street, a form of modern tribute to the global Minotaur. What do bankers do when such a tsunami of capital comes their way daily, when between $3 and $5 billion net passes through their fingers every morning of each week? They find ways to make it grow, to breed on their behalf. Thus, the 1980s, the 1990s, and the noughties saw an explosion of private money minting by Wall Street on the back of the daily capital tsunami that flowed to America to feed the global Minotaur. Just like its mythological predecessor, our global Minotaur kept the world economy going for decades. Until, that is, the pyramids of private money built upon the Minotaur's feeding tribute collapsed under their own impossible weight. Planet Earth was simply not large enough to hold so much private, toxic money, money like paper that burned down once the collapse began. In this conflagration, the global Minotaur was wounded critically. While in rude health, the Minotaur produced tremendous wealth and despicable inequality, new vistas of pleasure and new forms of deprivation, ample security for a few and crippling insecurity for most, great inventions and gadgets and spectacular failures of common decency. Whatever we think of the global Minotaur's reign, it kept the world going and its elites thinking that their regime was stable, successful, moderate even. With a Minotaur out of sight, keeping the show going from its secret labyrinth, its gross excesses remained out of sight, helping the great and the good, read Ben Bernanke, believe their own rhetoric about some great moderation that was supposedly the order of the day. But when the Minotaur keeled over, mortally wounded by the excess of its handmaidens in Wall Street, it left the global economy in disarray. In America and in Europe, in India and in China, the Minotaur's demise has put the world into a permanent crisis. The Cretan Minotaur was slain by a brave Athenian called Theseus. Its death, if you may recall, ushered in the new era of tragedy, history, philosophy. Our very own global Minotaur died less heroically, a victim of Wall Street bankers. What will its demise bring? Should we dare hope for a new era in which wealth no longer needs poverty to flourish? In which development means fewer ashes and abstract power wanes while everyone gets stronger? Whatever the result of history's mysterious ways, the global Minotaur will be remembered as a remarkable beast whose 30-year reign created and then destroyed the illusion that capitalism can be stable, greed a virtue, and finance productive. Thank you. Right, questions. I think I'm going to moderate myself. Okay, you have to line up against that microphone, I think. This is the way we do it here, isn't it?
Thanks for a really crystal clear, brilliant vision of where we've been. Could you elaborate a little more on where you think we're going with all this?
Very briefly, I think that we are in a state of sustained bewilderment. Because, let's face it, in the 1930s, the New Deal, despite some early successes, failed. By 1937-38, we had the second Great Depression. And it was only the war that managed to do the recycling that the New Deal eventually failed to accomplish as a result of FDR's backtracking. Now we have a world economy which, conceivably, technically, it's quite straightforward to plug the gaps and the black holes. The G20 could easily agree on a plan very similar to that which John Maynard Keynes was suggesting in 1944. But it's very unlikely that they will. Europe is a comedy of errors. Our European leaders are competing with one another as to who is going to prove more idiotic. And they are so entrenched in their positions and so parochial, they can't see beyond their own little squabbles. They have a horizon of 8 months for the next federal election in Germany, for instance. And Europe, therefore, is the sick person of Europe, that's Greece, of the world. Meanwhile, the United States of America is ungovernable because you have a constitution that you cherish in this country, which is as if it was created in order to turn this country into an ungovernable state. So you have Congress, White House, at loggerheads, canceling each other out. So how could the president, whoever the president might be, lead in the G20 like Truman and Roosevelt were doing before? And you have China trying its best to stimulate its economy, but finding it impossible to provide the missing demand that the West has done away with. So I have no answer to your question. Bewilderment.
My question's about consumer demand and the extent to which the old system depended upon it, and if we don't have it to the same degree, could there possibly be a new economy? And so I don't know how to say all these in right economic terms, but I'm just going to say what I'm thinking and then see what you make out of it, is that it seems like all economies got to a point where it had to be based on growth. It couldn't just be sustainable. It had to grow. And so that meant more consumers. And so then that led to a lot of things ecologically that weren't good for the earth and things that people did to maximize profit and reduce their costs and all these things. And so that's one thing. Is there the possibility that there might be a new economy that's not based on growth? Second, if you don't have consumer demand at the same level that you used to, and of course I think that's why one of those little pieces you talked about was the capital came here, that's because Americans are incredible consumers, way more than Europeans. I mean, I went in Ross dress for less.
Smoking causes cancer, the system's gonna fall soon to an angry young tune, and that's a concrete cold fact. The Pope digs population
freedom from taxation. Teeny bops are uptight, drinking at a stoplight. Miniskirt is flirting, I can't stop, so I'm hurting. Spencer sells her hopeless chest. Adultery plays the kitchen, bigger cops than fiction. The little man gets shafted, sons and money's drafted. Living by a timepiece, new war in the Far East. Can you pass the Rorschach test? It's a hassle, it's an educated guess. Well, frankly, I couldn't care less.